Good morning. We're looking at Isaiah chapter 44 and 45 this morning. We're in the section of the book of Isaiah that deals with comfort and deliverance for God's people. And one of the main reasons that is given for Israel being redeemed and saved is that they have the one true God. And this is in contrast to false gods. And we continue to see this theme of the one true God contrasted with false gods even in today's lesson, and it will continue on even into our next lesson. This section of the book runs from chapter 40 through 48. And there is a big theme through here of the greatness of God versus false gods or idols. And because of that, because there is the one true God who has created heaven and earth, and that theme of creation is just about in every chapter. He'll say something like, I've spread out the heavens and the earth, or I have created the heavens and the earth. That theme runs throughout, and it's because of that that Israel can be saved. They have the one true God. So this morning we're going to be continuing that theme in today's lesson. Sherry, we'll start with you this morning. What does the Lord do for Israel, His servant?
He gives water, He gives His Holy Spirit, and blessing.
Okay. I will help thee. I will help thee. And then He's going to bless them. And we made mention already in our last lesson that the word servant is used three different ways in the book of Isaiah for all of Israel who may be unfaithful and ungodly. They may be blind. They may be spiritually blind and deaf. Isaiah 42:19 is a good example of that. Who is blind but my servant? Or it could be, as it is in today's lesson, a reference to the faithful among them whom God will redeem. And so chapter 44, verse 1. Or it could be a reference to the Messiah who will come. And we'll begin to see that when we get over in the next section of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah 53 is a well-known a passage that talks about the Lord's servant. So keep that in mind as you go through the book. It could be all of Israel, including unfaithful people. It could be a smaller group of the remnant. It could be one man, Jesus Christ. So here we have, the faithful remnant, and God is going to save them. Eric, number two, how do the faithful remnant of the Lord's people describe themselves? Okay, I am the Lord's, and I belong to the Lord, and that needs to be our attitude today. We need to belong to the Lord and be willing to tell others that very thing. Okay, Joyce, number three, what does the Lord do to show that there is no other God besides Himself?
He proclaims the things that are coming and that shall come. He says there is no other rock, I know not one.
Okay. We mentioned this before, that this is a very important theme, that it's just about in every chapter. Look for the word declare or proclaim. God declares ahead of time. Let's read these few verses. Isaiah 44, 6 through 8. Thus saith Jehovah, the King of Israel, and His Redeemer, Jehovah of hosts. I am the first, I am the last, and besides me there is no God. And who as I shall call and shall declare it, and set it in order for me, since I established the ancient people, and the things that are coming that shall come to pass, let them declare. Fear ye not, neither be afraid. Have I not declared unto thee of old, and showed of it, and you are my witnesses? Is there a God besides me? Yea, there is no rock, I know not any. And so this, there is none besides me. We see this again in chapter 45 and verse 6. This is a very common theme through this section. I am the only God. And the proof of it is I can declare things that are to come. And we are getting into the portion of the book where we even have very specific prophecies, chapter 44, verse 28, of a specific man by name, 150 years before he even comes about. And so it's not just like today, you've got religious groups that are built upon prophecy. Joseph Smith said certain things were going to happen and they never did, and there's different kinds of religions that do that all the time. But given a little time, you can see that it just didn't come to pass. Well, these things came to pass, and they could know that the Lord is the one true God. So look for that throughout this section, chapter 40 through 48, this idea of I declare what is to come. That's a very important theme to show that God is true and these false gods are not. Okay, number four, Mike, how are the idol makers of Isaiah's day described? Right. So there's a constant contrast between the one true God and idols in these chapters that we're looking at right now. And we made mention before that different times during Isaiah's ministry, especially at the beginning, there were people who were engaged in idolatry. Hezekiah got rid of the idols, but in the first part of that ministry, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, God's people are engaged in idolatry. And so they have to be reminded of the one true God versus these vain, empty, shameful, you know, idols. And of course, in some countries today, that's still going on, particularly in Asia. There are a lot of different nations that have just a multitude of idols and gods. And you know, people are still doing that today. They need to turn to the one true God. A lot of it has to do with ignorance. In Acts 17, ignorance is a big thing. They're just born and raised in that culture. They're not taught any different, and they need to be taught the truth. Some of it, why did Israel, why did they turn to idols? It wasn't ignorance. They knew about the one true God, so it wasn't a matter of information or education. Why did the Israelites worship idols?
Intermarried?
Yeah, I'm not asking the influence, although that's what it was. They intermarried with the Canaanites, absolutely, and we're told about that, and that's why God said, don't do it. Don't intermarry, Deuteronomy, because they're going to influence you. That's where the influence came from. But why did they actually do it? What was the benefit to them? What was the incentive? You ever thought about that?
Be like those around them.
Okay, to be like those around them, but why were those around them doing it? Why do people worship idols? Okay, that's one thing. Man typically wants something that they can see with the physical eye. They feel better about that. What's another reason?
That's all they know.
That's all they know. Okay, that's what I said about the Israelites, though. They knew the one true God, so that's not their problem. Okay, what is it about it that they want?
You don't have to listen to God. You can make your own rules and your own
rules. Right. You're inventing this God in your own image. And so you can make him the way you want. But what did they make them to be that they wanted? What did idolatry allow them to do that they wanted to do? Yeah, sexual immorality. Some of it involved alcohol, strong drink. But a lot of it was sexual immorality. So it gives you a way to do what you want to do. And let's just be frank about it. A lot of it had to do with sexual immorality. And of course, worshiping God, he's not going to want me to do that. So I've got to invent my gods that will allow me to do that. And of course, the Israelites, when they were in Egypt, they were influenced a lot by idolatry there. But it wasn't a matter of they didn't know or they didn't hadn't known the truth. They knew the truth about God. They just didn't want him. And it starts in the days of the judges. That's when it started. And they had gotten in among the Canaanites, and because of intermarriage and things like that, that's where the influence came from. But the whole idea of being sold on it was, hey, I can go up on a hill, and there'll be drinking there, there'll be sexual immorality there, and for some reason, some of them got interested in burning their own children. I'm not really sure what the personal like of that would be. But anyway, some of them were doing that, child sacrifice to Molech, a Canaanite god. So there is a personal reason why I do this. And it's often to gratify the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. And I create gods in my image. I get to make up the rules. I get to make up the what the worship is going to be like, which involves immorality. So that's the appeal, and that's the reason. Because if I go by the one true God, I've got to follow His revelation, and that's strict and conservative and righteous and all of that. I don't want that. I want a looser living, so I create gods in my image, not the other way around. So that's something that is good for us to explore, because as God's people, we have to remain faithful to Him. We can't create things in our own image. We don't bow down to pieces of wood or stone today. But we've got to be careful about creating things in our image that we say, you know, are fine, and doing all of that. So this contrast between the one true God and idols is very prevalent here in this section of Isaiah. Okay, so they are vain, they're empty, there's just nothing to them, and the people who make them will be put to shame. Okay, number five, Janice, what do the blacksmith and the carpenter do to make idols? Right. The carpenter, of course, is going to form the wood, but the carpenter has tools that have been made by the blacksmith. And so they're using their talents, and these are God-given talents. It's great to be able to make things and all of that, but they're using their God-given talents to do wrong kinds of things. And so they work together and they make these idols. But look at verse 13. They shape it after the figure of a what? A man. What is idolatry? Idolatry is inventing gods in our image. In Genesis chapter 1, God made us in His image. That's the direction it's supposed to be. But when we turn around and make something in our image, then the whole thing is going to be built on our rules, our concepts, what our thinking is. And the Romans had a whole pantheon of gods. The Greeks had a whole pantheon of gods. And they were gods that were built, not just physically built, but in conceptually in the mind, built upon what we want to do. And so here's a god of wine, you know, Bacchus. Well, why? Because we want to drink wine. It's really a no-brainer, you know. Then you have a god of, you know, that is involved in sexual things and just on down the line. And so anyway, a god of war. If we want to go to war, you got a god of war, you know, all of that kind of thing. So anyway, verse 13 is very important. Idolatry is basically a false religion based upon making something in our image. Okay? Larry, number six, what does the idolater do with the wood that he brings from the forest? Right. And let's go ahead and take the next one that goes along with that. Mandy, number seven, what is the problem with the heart of the idolater? Right. This section goes together. The guy does three things. He burns the wood to get warm. Number two, sometimes he burns the wood to cook, and then sometimes he'll take that wood and make an idol out of it. And those same three things are mentioned in verses 18 through 20. And the point is that he just is not understanding. He's not using his senses to realize that, hey, this piece of wood, I'm burning it or I'm cooking with it, and then I'm going to make an idol. He's not using his mind to think, obviously the idol is not real. It's not, there's no God behind this. It's just wood that can be used in one of three ways. And he's not discerning. He's not thinking about that. That verse 20, his problem is a deceived heart. He's just, this whole thing is built upon a lie. And you're thinking, well, why would you even do that? Early on, it probably doesn't make sense to you and you see the problem with it. But can you teach yourself to believe a lie? Absolutely. You can deceive yourself long enough that you start believing a lie after a while. Absolutely. So maybe early on you're going, well, this is kind of silly. You know, I'm using this wood to cook with and then I'll take a piece of it and make an idol. But after a while, you can deceive yourself. So verse 20, it's a deceived heart. And it's just not discerning and understanding. And anybody with a discerning heart would realize that if you're using wood in these three ways, obviously the God is not real.
Bruce,
yes?
In verse 18 it says they not only shut their eyes, they shut their hearts.
Yes. They know not, neither do they consider. For he hath shut their eyes, and they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. So here's a hardened attitude. This is similar to Jesus in the parables, Matthew 13. They have eyes, but they don't see, and so forth. You can delude yourself. You can deceive yourself. You can harden your heart and your eyes and not want the truth. If you want something else badly enough, well, then I don't want the truth. So all of these factors are going together. And none calleth to mind, neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned a part of it in the fire. Yea, I have baked bread upon coals. I have roasted flesh. And then I shall make the residue thereof an abomination. We're not thinking. We're not discerning. And so that's the major problem. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. After a while, you don't say that. And it is. That's what that is. It's a lie. But after a while, you don't want to admit that or come clean with that. And I think early on, the Israelites probably realized that this is not right. But just over and over again, like in the book of Judges, that cycle of idolatry, and you're steeped in it for many, many years. After a while, you just buy into it. And especially the Israelite children that were born to idolatrous parents, that's the way they're going to be raised from the beginning. So, I mean, you're just buying into what mom and dad did, you know. Okay. So those are very, very good verses right through there. Okay. Janice, what does the Lord do for Israel, his servant? Right. So we have a contrast here between these false gods and idols. In verse 21, the true Redeemer, you know, the true God, and what he's going to do is he's going to blot out their transgressions. He's going to redeem them. And this is the servant that is the remnant, the faithful of God's people. Okay. So it's a contrast between what a false god cannot do and what the one true God does for faithful Israel. Okay? Matthew, number 9. What does the Lord do concerning his creation, the liars, and his messengers? Right. So again, false gods can't do a thing. What can I do? I'm going to save you. I'm going to redeem you. I can do the, I've made heaven and earth. And verse 24 is one of several creation verses in this section of Isaiah where God has shown his power and what he can do. So it's all in contrast to the folly of idolatry. Okay. God through Isaiah is trying to get these people away from this folly, this vanity, this emptiness, if he can. Okay. So I can create all things with regard to people who lie and these soothsayers and diviners and different people like that. I thwart their plans and so forth. But my servants, like Isaiah, true prophets, I confirm their message. And I show that their word comes true. Okay? Sherry, not just what does the Lord do, but what does he say concerning these three things? Jerusalem, the deep, and Cyrus. Right. And notice in verse 26 of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited. Well, in the days of Isaiah, she was inhabited. So I could see some people going, well, what's the big deal with that? We're inhabited right now. But they're going to be taken away into Babylonian captivity. And Isaiah talks about how that Babylon is going to come and take them away. But they are going to be able to return in the days of Cyrus. So Jerusalem will be rebuilt. He can say to the deep, be dried up. I will dry up thy rivers. God has the power to do that. And it was shown with, the Exodus from Egypt and the crossing of the Jordan. It's just a statement of his power. And then he will say to Cyrus, this is the king of the Medes and the Persians after the Babylonian Empire. He is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Let's talk about our number two under the digging deeper. First of all, how far in advance are we talking about here, roughly, between this statement and this verse and when Cyrus actually does it? Are we talking a year or two? What are we talking? About 150 years, when you look at Isaiah's ministry around 700 B.C., and maybe 7 to 740 B.C., and then down to Cyrus, who lets God's people return in 538 B.C., you're looking at about 150 years. And where in the Old Testament is this recorded? Ezra. Let's turn over to the book of Ezra. If you're making some notes beside Ezra 1 and verse 1, you can put 538 BC. 539 BC was when Cyrus conquered Babylon, and that's Daniel chapter 5, the last part of Daniel chapter 5. This is going to be what some call his first regnal year, or the first year that he's reigning over all people. So it's going to be 538. They came into Babylon in October of 539. His first full reigning year would be 538. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, about 538 BC, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished. So this is referring to Jeremiah's prophecy that they would be able to come back after 70 years, that the word of the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished. Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And then he talks about go up, let the people leave and go up and do all of that. So that's a reference here to Isaiah 44:28 and 45:1. He hath charged me to build him a house. And so Isaiah spoke of this about 150 years before it happened. We're not given the details about how that God stirred up his heart through providence, or, you know, I don't know if Cyrus read Isaiah, you know. We're not told the details of how he stirred up his heart, but it's in fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy, and it's also in fulfillment of this statement here in Isaiah. Okay? Number 10. Let's see. I'm sorry, number 11. Eric, what does the Lord do for Cyrus?
His right hand he has held to subdue nations before him and to loose the armor of Judah and to open before the double doors so that the gate shall not be shut, and I will go before you.
Okay. I wanted to say something here about Cyrus just to give you a heads up about something. Cyrus is mentioned in the last part of chapter 44, okay? There is mention of him here and there in 45 and all the way up to 46. And my point is, once you leave 45:1, you don't leave Cyrus. He's going to come back to that point later in chapter 45, okay? Look at verse 45:13. Just make a note. I have raised him up in righteousness. I have raised him. That's Cyrus again, okay? And then look at chapter 46 and verse 11. My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Notice in chapter 44 and verse 28, he will perform my pleasure. So chapter 46 in verse 10, I will do my pleasure calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man of my counsel, that's Cyrus, the man of my counsel from a far country. Yea, I have spoken, I will bring it to pass, I have purposed, I will also do it. So just make a note that these next couple of chapters is talking about how that God is going to raise up Cyrus, and he's doing this in advance to show that he is different from these false gods who can't do anything. Okay? And so, we're gonna see him, you know, pop up here and there. So the first thing that he does is, he raises him up and holds his hand so that he can conquer and subdue, kings. And he does that when he conquers Babylon. And, he gains riches and treasures and so forth. So God is going to raise up Cyrus to do his will in letting God's people come back to rebuild the temple, to rebuild Jerusalem. And he's saying this in advance to show that he's not like false gods who can't declare the future. Okay, Joyce, number 12, what does the Lord use Cyrus to do for the Lord's benefit? Exactly. Verse 4, I have called thee by thy name. That's Cyrus again, okay? And he's going to do that and call him and use him so that others can know, all people can know from the east and the west that the Lord is the true Lord and there's no other beside him. And so it's a specific example of declaring something in the future, 150 years in advance, and a specific man by a specific name. And it all has the purpose of showing that God is the one true God. And so it works in the Lord's benefit that way. And that's interesting. Though thou hast not known me. Cyrus is a pagan. He doesn't know the one true God, but he's actually going to be doing the Lord's will, before it's over with. Okay, Mike, number 13. What does the Lord call upon the sky and the earth to do? Good. And that shows up a lot in Isaiah that God is a righteous God. He wants his people to be righteous. His way is righteous. Okay. All of that's in contrast to false idols. Okay, and Janus, number 14, what two woes does Isaiah pronounce against those who would question the Lord? Right. Ungodly Israel is striving with their maker, capital M. They're striving with God. They're idolatrous. They're hypocritical. They have all these problems that are mentioned, especially in the early part of the book of Isaiah. And remember we had a section there earlier in Isaiah, the six woes? These are ungodly people who are striving with their maker, and they're acting like a piece of clay who says to the potter, you know, why are you doing this and why are you doing that? So they're questioning God. They're striving with God. Here's a little section where we jump back to talk about ungodly Israel. Okay? And Larry, number 15, what does the Lord remind his people of concerning himself and Cyrus? Right. Look at verse 11. I'm your maker. Verse 9, you're striving with your maker. I am the Holy One. I am your maker. Okay. And I have made the earth and created man upon it. Okay. Again, another creation passage here in Isaiah to remind them that when I create things, they're doing, it's doing what I have commanded, and I am going to raise up Cyrus in righteousness. That goes back to verse 8. Let the heaven and earth bring forth righteousness. I will make straight his ways. I've created things. I'm raising up Cyrus. I am your maker. I'm the one true God. Notice in verse 11 what Cyrus is going to do. And this is Ezra chapter 1. He shall build my city. Well, how did he do that? By allowing Israel to come back. And he told, if you read Ezra, he told the people that stayed behind, give these Jews personal silver, gold, personal things, and let them take them back there. So that's one way that the temple was rebuilt. He funded that. And he shall let my exiles go free. Okay? So that's Ezra chapter 1. Okay? Mandy, number 16. What do the Egyptians, Ethiopians, and Sabaeans do with regard to Israel and the Lord? Right, they're going to come to Israel, and they're going to bow down, and they're going to worship the one true God. We're not told, we don't know exactly why Egypt, Ethiopia, and the Sabaeans are selected. Maybe these are representatives of other people. But in days to come, the other people, other than Israel, is going to come to Israel and is going to recognize the one true God. And of course, we see that even more so on Pentecost and the establishment of the church and people coming from different parts of the known world to hear the gospel. But there's going to come a day where people are going to come and recognize the one true God. And again, this is in contrast to idolatry. Okay, Janus number 17, what happens to idol makers and what happens to Israel? Right. Notice this contrast between if you worship the one true God, there is no shame, but if you worship idols, there is shame. There is that contrast that's also found in this section of the book of Isaiah. So God is a Savior. The true Lord is a Savior. He's going to save His people and others who come to Him. But if you're following idols, you're not going to be saved. You're going to be confounded and put to shame. Confounded, the older versions, confused, we would say. Okay. And number 18, Matthew, why does the Lord create the earth and what does the Lord declare? Right. And again, another creation passage. There's several of these in this section of the book of Isaiah to contrast what the Lord can do with His power and these false gods who can't do anything. And again, God speaks and declares what is right. this righteousness. We see it in verse 13. We see it in verse 8 and so forth. Okay? And number 19. Sherry, what do idols not do? And what does the Lord do for all who come to Him? Exactly. And, you know, these contrasts, and I meant to be doing this all along as we were going through, but these contrasts that are made in the book of Isaiah, we'll just get to that. Remember these contrasts that we've already pointed out. God is the creator of all things. Idols are created by men. God can declare the future. Idols cannot declare the future. Those who worship the one true God are glorified. Those who worship idols are ashamed. And then God is the only God versus there are no idols. And then in today's lesson, let's look at a couple of contrasts. There are true witnesses of God who have the Israelites who have been able to witness all of the things that He's done in the past. Notice that they will not be put to shame. They're not afraid. But the false witnesses, they are afraid. The Lord saves, idols do not save. And then when we get over into our next lesson, I find this contrast really interesting. God carries His people. He supports them. He takes care of them. But people carry gods. Look at chapter 46. Verses 1 and 2, Bel and Nebo are gods of Babylon. Look, it says that they carry them on beasts and it weighs them down. They're carrying all of these wooden idols, stone idols, gold and silver idols. And if you pack them all up in a bag and you carry them, that's going to be a lot of weight, right? So it's pictured as, you know, they're weighed down with these idols. But then read the very next verse, verse 3 and 4. God says, I have borne my people. I'm carrying my people. But people who worship idols, they're carrying this weight of idols. It's a really neat, I think, contrast. So, would you rather carry around the weight of idols, or would you rather be carried by God? So, I think the choice is pretty obvious there. So there are a lot of contrasts, and right here at the end of chapter 45, of course, God saves, but false gods do not. So Isaiah is trying to get his people out of idolatry. And notice that this salvation, verse 22, is all the ends of the earth. And so it's not just going to be for Jews, but ultimately, through the Messiah, it's going to be the gospel is for all, Jew and Gentile. Let's look at a few applications today before we close. The Lord is the first and the last. He's also mentioned that way in Revelation 1, verse 8. The Lord is the only true God. There is one God and Father of all, Ephesians 4, 6. We need to guard ourselves from idols, the creation of our own hands. And especially we looked at chapter 44, verse 13. He shapes it after the figure of a man. We need to be careful that we are not making something in our own image. And so 1 John 5:21, my little children, guard yourselves from idols. People who worship idols lack understanding and are deceived. They need the truth of God's word. And you know, Mason talked about this Wednesday night, Acts 17. This God whom you've described as the unknown God, He is the one that you worship in ignorance, Paul says. A lot of times it's a matter of ignorance, and especially in today's world where it's just been passed on from generation to generation in India, other places that have multitudes of gods. It's just passed on through the family, and that's all you know. And so that's why it's important when brethren can take the gospel around the world today. I'm glad brethren are in India trying to get people off of this lie, this deceit, this emptiness of idolatry and get them to serving the one true God. That's great. And we need to pray for brethren that they'll have success, you know, in doing that. Only the Lord can declare something to happen in detail before it happens. And that's what is going on here, especially with Cyrus. Okay? The Lord uses world leaders to accomplish His purposes. Did you notice in the Bible that different, and even in the book of Isaiah here, different kings are described? Tiglath-Pileser in chapter 10 and verse 5 is described as the rod of mine anger. Nebuchadnezzar is called my servant, Jeremiah 43:10, because he came and conquered Jerusalem and punished wicked Israel. Cyrus is called my shepherd in 44:28. He's called his anointed or God's anointed, 45:1. He's called my counsel, God's counsel, 46:11. Why are these men called this? Because they're fulfilling God's plans. They're doing His purposes. And Proverbs 21:1 talks about how that the heart of the king is in God's hand and He turns it the way He wants. And so God, and I believe that that's still true today with our president and with other people. God is going to use men to fulfill His purposes one way or the other. Number 7, we must be careful to never question the Lord's wisdom or plans. We don't need to be striving with our Maker, chapter 45, verse 9, or questioning God. Why have you done such and such, you know? And then number 8, the Lord saves, but idols do not save. God is our Savior, Luke 1:47. We don't need to turn to someone else or something else for salvation. We just need to turn to God. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your time and attention. And in our next lesson, we'll look at chapters 46 through 48. And that will conclude this section of the book of Isaiah. And then when we get into 49, that will be the section dealing with primarily with things that have to do with the coming Messiah. And that's going to be an encouraging thought when we get into that section. Thank you.